Did you know that as more people listen to WNYC on the internet, our bandwidth expenses go up? Please do your part to support WNYC's online services. Click the ePledge button to make your gift now. And thanks.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
I know I'd go from rags to riches if you would only say you care. And though my pockets may be empty, I'd be a millionaire, just like Elton.
My clothes may still be torn and tattered, but in my heart I'd still be king. Your love is all that ever matters. It's everything.
If you'd sold 50 million records worldwide, won 13 Grammys and an Emmy, you'd probably be content to rest on your laurels. But then you're not Tony Bennett, who, even after celebrating his 80th birthday this past August, has just come out with a new CD for Columbia Records. On it, he's recorded his favorite songs with everyone from Barbara Streisand to Bono, Stevie Wonder, and the Dixie Chicks. It's called Duets, an American Classic, and I'm delighted to have the chance to speak with Tony Bennett once again. Hello.
Hello there.
So how did you go about celebrating your birthday? Was it a lot of fun?
Well, we had a beautiful time. Target was our sponsor for the TV show on NBC.
Are you doing a TV show? That's coming up next month on November 21st.
Yes, November 21st. Yes, the ratings week for the year.
So you celebrated your birthday with a television show?
Right, but actually they did it at the Planetarium over on the West Side and the Museum of Natural History, and it was beautiful. It was one of the best times of my life.
Did they stick 80 candles on a cake when you're 80 years old?
They just put one candle on it.
But I'd imagine with your breath control, because you sing without a mic. I would think that if anybody could blow out 80 candles, it would be you.
No, not 80 candles. That they were nice enough to be human about it. They gave me one candle.
And there have been a lot of celebrations. You've won a bunch of awards this year, the United Nations,
really,
Kennedy Center.
Kennedy Center, yes. And the Endowment of the Arts made me a jazz master, which is unbelievable because it goes to Duke Ellington or Count Basie. And it's really a wonderful honor for me because I know no corporate companies like to hear this, but I'm really a jazz singer. When I listen to all my records that I've made through the years, the ones that were with jazz artists are really the best records I've ever made, like Stan Getz or Bill Evans, like that.
Well, the Bill Evans are among the greatest collaborations in the history of jazz. But I remember speaking to you some years ago, and you told me you didn't think of yourself as a jazz singer. You said you were a bel canto singer.
Well, I am a bel canto. I mean, I preserve my voice that way. It's just a wonderful technique of, you know, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice. And I saw a beautiful concert last night on PBS with the Cleveland Symphony last night. To see everybody in this mad commercial world we live in, to see everybody in beautiful tuxedos at Carnegie Hall with that great Cleveland Symphony Orchestra playing Mozart, it's just, you know, there's such a sense of sanity for me to sit there and listen to beautiful music the right way.
So you listen to classical music as well?
Oh, yeah.
You also,
it's the real thing.
You also have another celebration of a sort. I don't know when it actually takes place, but you've been with Columbia Records for, I don't know,
50 years.
50 years.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You said that at one point you could have retired. In fact, was it 5 years ago? What made you decide not to?
Because I'm not finished I am fortunate over the fact that I have a passion to sing and paint. So I've become a perpetual student. I have the greatest painter in America, academic painter in America, Everett Raymond Kinsler, who's the best portrait painter in America since Sargent. And we went to art school when we were kids in the High School of Industrial Art, right outside the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And we met many years later, and for the last 20 years he's been teaching me to paint and getting me together with some of his colleagues like Charles Reed in Connecticut, who's the most beautiful watercolorist. And the both of them have a good sense of values when it comes to painting. And they've just helped me so much with my work.
Hasn't the Smithsonian bought one of your paintings?
Absolutely, yes. This year, that's another accolade that happened to me that I'll never get over. I mean, I'm in company of John Singer Sargent and Winslow Homer. It's pretty good, you know. I can't get over it.
So do you see some connection between singing and painting?
Well, I think all of the arts have a connection. The economy, the line form, color, balance, you know, learning what to leave out. I think they pertain to cooking. If you're playing sports, like a game like tennis, it pertains to that, you know, never pushing, not just letting things flow. And all of these things really pertain to the creative arts. There is a common bond with all of the arts.
One of the reasons some people retire is they just get tired of touring.
That's the opposite with me. Now, I'm going to do a major name-dropping thing at this moment when you brought this question up, because Cary Grant told me, he said, look, he said, do cameo parts in the movies, but don't do movies. He said, they're really so boring. You step on wires, and you don't know if the pains, the movie's going to come out. You know, if it does, so what? You know, and all that. He said, just go out and perform and be alive, be in front of audiences cheering you on. And I took his advice. In the last 15 years, I've just decided to spend my life performing and doing cameo parts in films every once in a while. But that would just take one day, one or two days. But most of the time, I'd be in front of beautiful halls. The best one is Carnegie Hall or Royal Albert Hall in Britain. And in the summertime, we play to big venues like the Hollywood Bowl or Ravinia in Chicago or Wolf Trap in Washington, D.C. But I work live. And so now I do about 7 dates a month, and the rest of the time I spend painting.
And even on this record, you kind of worked live. You've recorded duets in the past. In fact, you recorded one with Billie Holiday,
right,
long after she was dead, the same way that Natalie Cole did with her father. Mm-hmm. But here, I understand you decided to record all of these tracks really live,
right,
one take. And if that didn't work, another take. But you weren't going to do a lot of editing or any mm-hmm. editing?
We tried to make it like a vocal jam session, the way great musicians get together and just take out their horns and play instinctively. And I decided these fellas, all the young contemporary artists and composers, and we kind of went halfway around the world. We went to make it, when they were so nice enough to agree to do this, we went to them instead of having them come to me, and we went to Los Angeles with Barbra Streisand. We sang right in her beautiful living room and overlooking Malibu Beach. And
with your regular rhythm section? Your
yes.
So you brought them to her house?
Mm-hmm. And, but we went everywhere that way.
And Abbey Road with Paul McCartney.
Yes, Paul McCartney, that Ray Noble song, you know, is beautiful, The Very Thought of You. And
well, that must have been weird for him, because that's where the Beatles recorded.
He loved it, because he hadn't gone into that studio until that first big record, the white record that they made. And it was, he's mentioned where John Lennon stood, and Ringo, where the drums were set up, and he loved doing it in that studio again.
So the logistics of putting this album together must have been enormous.
It was.
Moving
it
everybody was. Around.
Yeah. Then I have a studio in Englewood, New Jersey, right here in New Jersey. And we had Tim McGraw and Diana Krall, Billy Joel, Elvis Costello. We did that here in New York.
Well, you say you have a studio, and you own a studio there?
It's the Bennett Studios, yes.
That's where Rudy Van Gelder used to be.
Yeah, it's right down the road from my great friend Rudy, yes.
He was probably the greatest jazz engineer ever.
The nicest man, too.
So in this case, you recorded just standing next to each other, no editing, very old-fashioned. What did you hope to achieve?
My old-fashioned, you know, it's funny. It's really the right way because I've been recording for 50 years, and I recorded before they were able to splice things and put them together and take one number one take to number 15 take and put it together like it was one take. And we never did that. We had to walk in very prepared. I followed Billie Holiday into the recording studios, and in those days, you just had to do the whole record very rehearsed. You had to know what you were doing. And as a result, it's more spontaneous, once again, with the jazz premise. If you do it over and over again, it becomes, you know, something flattens out. The musicians get tired of playing it or whatever. So you have to try and do it in one to three takes or four takes most.
But I'll bet none of the people you recorded with had ever done anything like that.
No, they never did anything. And surprisingly, they were all thrilled with it. They said, you know, this is a great way to record. We should, because usually the majority of them take 25 to 30 weeks to put an album out. And they might add a trumpet 25 weeks later or a piano or whatever. And they never worked that spontaneously.
And then there's one track that only took one take that became a number one hit.
That's Elton John, yeah. He came right in. He was very prepared. I was surprised with all of them. All of these artists like, you know, Celine Dion and Diana Krall, Stevie Wonder. I can't tell you the time I had with Stevie Wonder. He is the best jazz singer I've ever heard.
But in his case, he'd already recorded the song after you had, so...
Right, I introduced the song with Tori Zito. And then, but they were smart enough to, he was 16 years old at the time, and they put a beat behind it and sold millions of records on For Once in My Life. But now it's so retributional for me because we finally did a duet together, and that's the highlight to me as far as I'm concerned. Streisand and Stevie Wonder doing it, right at, the set was at Carnegie Hall on TV, and it's really fabulous.
So how did you work it out? In all but one track, you start off, and then your duet partner then does an equal amount. Sometimes you sing harmony, sometimes you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Were these things arranged?
They were pretty much arranged, yes. We had pre-planned it with the quartet that I have, a wonderful quartet with Lee Musica and Paul Langosch and Harold Jones and Grace Sargent on the guitar.
Lee Musica is a pianist. You've had a history of working with great pianists.
Oh, Ralph Sarin, yeah.
And Tommy Flanagan at one point.
Flanagan,
then
yeah.
You did all those collaborations with Bill Evans, which are some of the greatest records ever made.
Oh, gosh.
And on this one, you also have Bill Charlap.
I love Bill Charlap. I love everything about him. He's so inspiring to be around. I love the Gershwin album he made. I love the album he made with his mother, who's a beautiful singer. And I just love the guy personally. He's just one of my great friends.
So what happens when in this case, you're doing these duets with people you haven't worked with before, except for Katie Lang.
Right.
But with your quartet, these are people you're very comfortable with.
Right.
And you've had people work with you for long periods all throughout your career. Are there certain things that they give you, or is it because you feel you can just lean on them and know that they'll be there that that led you to take them all over the world for this recording?
Well, you know, I was a little apprehensive about this. This was really my son's premise. He said, I want you to do this album. And I was very apprehensive about it. I just said, wait a minute, you know, and yet the reaction was so strong that immediately NBC said, we'd love to do a special with you on this. I, whoops, this is it, you know. And that's very rare to have them accept a big budget. Target is the sponsor, and it's just unbelievable what's going on. But all these artists, what I like about these are the new institutional artists.
These are the big stars of
and they're
the,
our and lifetime. They're going to be around. And but what I liked about it that I was completely surprised with, I was wondering how professional are they going to be? You know, they're new artists, and you know, you end up tragically. We all end up with kind of an attitude about things sometimes, and they really it's not. I learned that I'm not correct about thinking that way, because what I found out from these folks, every one of them, from the Dixie Chicks on, James Taylor, you know, Juanez from South America, they were all very professional. They were all very prepared. They came in. They were all lovely to be with. And we did it like a jam. It's a vocal jam session. We did them all in 3 and 4 takes. Elton John did it in 1 take. That's how prepared he was.
Well, I'm sure they were all thrilled to be working with you, as I am thrilled to be talking to you.
Thank you very much.
Tony Bennett, and we'll continue this conversation after we take a little break. Mm-hmm. His CD is Duets, an American Classic, just out from Columbia. And on November 21st, that's a Tuesday at 8 p.m. on NBC, Tony Bennett, an American Classic, with many of the same people on the record and a few other ones, will be broadcast. It's directed by Rob Marshall, which has to make it even more extraordinary. Stay with us for more.
The very thought of you and I forget to do the little ordinary thing everyone ought to do.
I'm living in a kind of daydream. I'm happy as a king and foolish though it may seem.
Along and listen to the lullaby of Broadway, the hip hooray and ballyhoo, the lullaby of Broadway.
The rumble of those subway trains, the rattle of the taxis, the daffodils who entertain at Angelo's and Maxie's.
When a Broadway baby said goodnight, it's early in the morning. Manhattan babies didn't sleep tight until the dawn.
Good night, baby. Good night.
The milkman's on his way. Sleep tight, babies. Sleep tight.
Let's call it a day.
Hey! Come on along and listen to the lullaby of Broadway.
We're back with Tony Bennett, whose most recent album is Duets, an American Classic, which is released by Columbia Records, the company he's been with for 50 years. There's also a television show called Tony Bennett, an American Classic, directed by Rob Marshall, which will be airing on Tuesday, November 21st at 8 p.m. This thing was produced by Phil Ramone, who did Frank Sinatra's 2 duet albums.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done other things with you?
That was the first one, yeah.
So, and you recorded with Sinatra on one of those, of course, not in the same way.
Right. But most of these were all live. You know, whenever it was possible, we did it all live.
What makes for a good duet? Should the voices be similar?
No, it should be contrasting. That's the game. That's the challenge, you know, to try and remind everyone when we're recording that try and be... make sure that when I stop singing, that when the next voice comes in, you can hear the difference between the two singers.
But these are singers who all have very different styles. So who makes the adjustment?
Most of it just happened automatically. I was a little concerned about it. But then when they started performing, the one that was a little troubling to me, although it was really the best singing on the whole album, was Billy Joel.
Why was
Billy
troubling?
Joel is known as a rock singer, but actually he's a devil because he really knows the difference between really singing well. He's a hell of a musician, really. You know, technically, He knows the piano. He knows how to read music very well.
He's written a couple of
good
songs.
Much more so than you know, many artists like Count Basie and Sinatra and Perry Como years ago, and people like myself, you know, we just follow our intuition and sing, you know. But Billy's a very well-schooled musician. I have great respect for him that way. But he did sound in the same tradition of singing, like a Sinatra, like a Nat Cole, or like Tony Bennett, that kind of he can sing a lot better than when he sings rock. He sings a lot better when he just sings a nice croons, when he becomes a crooner, as they say.
I was surprised by Paul McCartney, who sounded like
he
got right into the Tony Bennett spirit.
Oh, yeah.
How did you wind up singing The Very Thought of You with him, or any of these songs with these people? Did they choose the songs that they wanted?
They did. We gave each artist... I've introduced about 35 songs into the Great American Songbook, and they're now standards because Columbia did a lot of things with me from Broadway shows that became famous, like Kismet with Stranger in Paradise, or Just in Time from Julie Stein's song show on Broadway. But there was many of them that I did that came out of Broadway.
In those days, that's what happened. Broadway wrote the great hit songs came out of Broadway, and if you mm-hmm. were lucky, you wound up being the one paired with the song.
Well, what happened is they had me. I was selling so many records at the time. I was the Michael Jackson of my day, mm-hmm. so I had so many millions selling records that they wanted that the cast album for Columbia Records, and they would say, "We'll give you a Tony Bennett record if you give us the cast album." And they would take it. And so for about 6 years, I did all these wonderful standard songs.
So these songs, have they had certain significance for you? For example, Lullaby Broadway.
Harry Vaughan.
That was on an album you did in 1957, and here you're doing it with the Dixie Chicks.
Right. And they had never done a swing tune. After they did it, they said, "Gosh, we should make some music like this." And I loved the way they sang that, you know. They reminded me of the Andrews Sisters on it.
Yeah, they gave you first. You had you shared solos with their lead singer, and then there were the harmonies
right.
that occurred.
It came out right, really nice. I like the way they sang.
And then Smile.
That was right over the fence. The Barbara Streisand. I mean,
but you'd recorded before, but she never recorded.
She never did. No, and at first she wondered why. I said, "Barbara, knowing the way you feel about life and everything, I said, this song has to be sung." I said, "Because it's the lines, you know, when there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by. If you just smile, you know, keep your spirits up, keep your hope up." And relating to 9/11, you know, I said, we got to do this song. And boy, she really knocked it out of the ballpark. She sings beautiful.
A lot of people don't realize Charlie Chaplin wrote that song.
I know. He's a master.
So, and then one of the odd things is that you sang Hank Williams' Cold, Cold Heart.
Well, you know, I always thought I was able to, I had the hit on it when I was very young. I really still didn't get it all together in those days. And it was a big hit. And I remember Mitch Miller saying to me, I said, "It's a beautiful Hank Williams song, but I said, I wouldn't know how to sing it. I'm a city boy and it's a country song." He said, "Well, if we have to tie you to a tree, you're going to sing it." So he tied me to a tree, and I sang it. And at first I was wondering about it, but it became such a big hit. It was the first country song that sold internationally around the world.
Had Hank Williams, was he alive at the time?
He was, and he called me from Nashville, Tennessee, and he said, "Tony," he said, "what's the idea of ruining my song?" And, you know, when I heard Tim McGraw sing it with me, I realized what he was talking about, because, boy, Tim just, there is another way of singing a country song. And he taught me on this date how to do it right, to do it the right way to do it.
So you were helping Barbara Streisand, being a kind of a producer, and then when you sang with Tim McGraw, he kind of gave you hints.
Exactly. He taught me
even
how to
people
sing
like Barbara Streisand and Tony Bennett can learn.
Right.
You, the last time you were on the show, we talked about your mm-hmm. life born Anthony Dominic Benedetto and growing up in Astoria. But I don't know if we mentioned that your father was a grocer.
Right. So just like Governor Cuomo, his father was a grocer also.
Was there a lot of music in the house?
Oh, there was. You know, it was during the Depression. My father died when I was 10 years old, so I didn't really know him that well. But he used to sing. The legend was, it was more than a legend. It was, the whole family told me about it, all my relatives. He used to stand on top of this mountain in Padagani in Calabria and sing with such volume that the whole valley would hear him. And that really inspired my brother, who ended up as a 14-year-old boy being called the Little Caruso and sang in the Metropolitan Opera and that inspired me to this day. I just have such a passion to sing. I love doing it, you know.
But also, sometimes you sing without a mic.
Right.
There aren't too many other singers who do that anymore.
Well, that's that bel canto training, you know, that after I came out of the service, I joined the theater wing under the GI Bill of Rights, and a wonderful school. And because, as Studs Terkel calls it, the good war, it was really amazing that that they gave us the best teachers in New York City. I mean, Stanislavski's secretary taught me acting.
Really?
Pietro D'Andrea taught me bel canto. Mimi Spear on 52nd Street, right on the Great Jazz Street, showed me how to imitate musicians rather than singers, so that you could come up with your own style.
You can't imagine that happening anymore, people coming back from the Iraq War.
Well, I hope if they come back, they should be treated even better, you know, because they've had a tough time.
So at the beginning, like everybody, you probably imitated other people. Was Frank Sinatra an early inspiration?
Big influence, big. He was my master, you know, Frank Sinatra. So much so that now I've named a school, the Frank Sinatra School of the Arts, a public school. The city of New York was, I can't believe my life. I mean, from where I started, they gave me $70 million to open up a school right here in Long Island City. And it's been open 6 years now. There's not one dropout. The students love it there. They have to audition to get in. And not only that, but 94% of them all go to college. And it's a wonderful school for dancing, for music, for theater. And it's Polchek, who did the planetarium design in the Clinton
James Stewart Polchek
Library. He's doing the building. It'll be ready about 2008.
Now, Frank also helped your career, didn't he?
He did, because he considered me his favorite singer. So as a result, all of his fans said, "What the heck's Frank talking about? Let's go hear him." And all of a sudden, my audiences have filled up. To this day, the last 30 years, I've been sold out everywhere I play in the world. It's amazing.
But there's you don't sing like Frank Sinatra. There's obvious influences.
No, but it was
when did you figure it out?
You had Nat King Cole, you had Ella Fitzgerald. You know, you had Sarah Vaughan, you had the great singers, you know, and the level of popular music was a lot higher in those days. It came out of the dance bands, you know, with Ellington and Basie and Woody Herman and Stan Kenton. And there was such a level of the audience loved that kind of music. And it just changed so much now, you know.
And you opened for Pearl Bailey early in your career.
That's right. She started me out in Greenwich Village, and it was Bob Hope who came in to see Pearlie Mae down in the village. He was at the Paramount with Jane Russell and Les Brown's band, and he got a big kick out of me because I was the only white kid in the show. He said, "Come over here, son." He said, "What's your name?" I said, "It's Joe Barry." He said, "Come on." He said, "That's a city in Italy. You know, what's your real name? Give me your real name." I said, "Well, it's Anthony Dominic Benedetto." He said, "Well, that's a little long for the marquee." He said, "Let's make it simple. Tony Bennett." He said, "Let's call you Tony." He gave me my name, Tony Bennett. He had no idea that there would ever be a singer called Engelbert Humperdinck.
But you were a tenor in those days, weren't you?
Right. I'm still a tenor, but I make believe I'm a baritone.
Well, there actually, to some degree, it has to do with the quality of a voice, doesn't it? There are tenors who have those big voices, and there are the other ones.
Well, you know, Bing Crosby, and no one remembers this, unfortunately, but Bing, for 7 years, was the number one box office in movies and everything. And he invented the art of intimate singing. And then, of course, Sinatra took it to another level where it's very intimate. You know, when you hear a Nat Cole record, it's really done as a whisper. There's many records that Ella Fitzgerald, when you really listen clearly to her, and you listen really, like, how is she singing? It's really almost in a whisper. But, you know, it helps your intonation, and there's a jazz thing that happens throughout it, a spontaneous feeling. It's full of inspiration that way.
I'm still amazed every time I listen to Ella that her ears were so incredible that she could improvise the way she did. And she's the closest thing to a saxophone player.
Duke Ellington made an album with her. The Duke made an album with her, a salute to Ella Fitzgerald, and actually wrote a whole suite for her. And I'll tell you, that's one of the best vocal records I've ever heard in my life.
But when you were recording with Bill Evans, there must have been times when you felt like you were left hanging and you just had to pull all of your musicianship together.
Not with Bill Evans, no. Bill Evans was the best accompanist. He had such a high level of musicality that all the phrases were resolvements, so that it was almost in unison with me, and yet it was an expanded chords that was so wide and beautiful, a carpet that you could just sing beautifully on.
Well, to me, what you have, the two of you had, was a desire to think a song through and make it something personal, make it surprising, even if we've heard it a million times.
Exactly. I tell you, my game is it's a funny game. It has nothing to do with money. But what it is to try and do a definitive version of a song that you love. You know, it might be a song like Stella by Starlight. But you think about it, instead of just saying, well, here's another tune, let's do it. Instead of thinking that way, I give it a lot of time and just say, how could I do this? How could I change up and make a production out of this song so it'll just be the definitive version of that song? And Nat Cole, to this day, I love a song that Billy Strayhorn wrote called Lush Life. I just love it.
The saddest song ever
written. Saloon song ever written. And yet, I know that Nat really made the definitive version of that song. And
Johnny Hartman did a pretty good version,
I know what you're saying. It's a great song, believe me, and I love Johnny Hartman. But Nat took that song with Les Baxter's band, and it's gorgeous. I could hear it all day long.
Well, you did that with a lot of songs, but the one that I'm sure most people still associate with you is I Left My Heart in San Francisco, and that's the only song that you sing here solo. You don't have a duet on it.
Right, that's with Bill Shalop.
Do you ever get tired of singing a song like that?
You get tired of making love? I told that. Well, never mind. We won't go into that.
This is a family show, but when you heard that song, or when you heard some of the other songs that you've really done well with, did you know immediately that it was right for you, or is this something that you have to take over and work out for yourself?
You know, it's all about proper involvement. Ralph Sarin for about 30 years played for me, and even though I've had other beautiful piano players, you know, I've just been blessed with great piano players.
Well, you choose them, obviously.
Yeah, but, you know, I must tell you that Ralph never played a wrong note for me. Every single note is right in the feeling that he has on those records are just so real and so honest that in fact, he told me one day when we all get butterflies and am I doing it right and all that. And he told me one day, he says, someday you're going to like all these records that you made. And sure enough, now on my 80th birthday, that's happening. They made a box set for me, and I started listening to it. And each one, there's something to each record. You know, it's not just a throwaway.
You still get butterflies?
Oh, sure. You got to. You hope that people will like what's happening. You hope that the sound, you know, you hope that you remember all the words. You hope that the night is right for everybody, you know. And then once the show hits, then of course you just take over.
And you listen to your own recordings, because most singers and musicians tell me they can't listen to the things that they did.
Well, realistically, you're not going to release a record unless it just sounds right. And so that when they finally, it does sound right. And like if you hear like a Johnny Mandel orchestration and you hear these great musicians, the soloists that were playing on it, you know, and it sounds just right, I love it.
Tony Bennett's new CD is Duets, Tony Bennett Duets, an American classic on Columbia. And then there's the TV show of the same title, directed by Rob Marshall, which will be airing Tuesday, November 21st at 8 p.m. It has been my great pleasure to talk with Tony Bennett again. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. I left my heart in San Francisco, high on a hill, it calls to me to be where little cable cars climb halfway to the stars. The morning fog may chill the air. I don't care, my love waits there in San Francisco, above the blue and windy sea. When I come home to you, San Francisco, your golden sun will shine for me.
Thanks for listening to The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.